lines this hour. British ruling party figures warn that Prime Minister Boris Johnson could be gone within a year amid a series of scandals involving him and his aides. Iran says the European members of the JCPOA have accepted its proposals as a basis for future talks. The EU says difficult political decisions have to be made. And Australia reports record high new COVID-19 cases for a third consecutive day as the country continues to ease pandemic curbs. Thanks for joining us. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been in hot water recent weeks amid a series of scandals leading to a decline in public support for him. Johnson is now facing a waning support from within his own Conservative Party as senior members demand a government shakeup. The members say that Johnson could be gone within a year unless he cleans up his act and that he is on notice. Just on Thursday, UK Conservatives lost their parliamentary seat in North Shropshire after almost 200 years. That happened amid controversies over a number of parties held at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns last year. Johnson apologized and his advisor resigned to ease public anger, but to no avail. Things even got uglier after reports emerged of parties held at the office of the senior civil servant tasked with investigating the previous gatherings. The official quit the probe following those reports. France's election race has just gotten quite a bit tighter. A recent poll shows that the mainstream Conservative Party's new candidate will defeat Emmanuel Macron. The incumbent president immediately went into damage control mode with a rare media interview. Rami Mazzari has more on that story.
French President Emmanuel Macron didn't give a press conference until more than 2 years into his presidency, but he gave a two-hour televised interview shortly after the publication of the first poll, which shows him losing in the second round of the April election. The primary of the mainstream Conservative Party recently selected Valérie Pécresse, a former budget minister under Nicolas Sarkozy, and a new poll has her beating Macron 52-48 in the final round.
The traditional Conservatives are bouncing high in the polls, thanks to the buzz from being newly united around a single person. They've lost a lot of votes in 2017 due to their candidate's perceived corruption. But with a restructured party and message, the rumours of their total demise may have been premature.
In 2017, the Conservative candidate, François Fillon, was disgraced by a tremendous scandal over fake jobs, and yet he still almost made the second round. Many say the poll is a reminder of the historic strength of the mainstream Conservative Party, and also of Emmanuel Macron's almost permanently low approval ratings.
The one thing this poll makes clear is that Pécresse will at least be among the top three candidates of the first round. For her to advance, she really needs the support of Marine Le Pen to crumble, and also to attract many of Macron's dissatisfied voters, but it's too early to say if that will happen.
Pécresse hasn't come out of nowhere, but few expected that she would be in this position. She is often considered the Conservative most similar to Macron, so a Pécresse-Macron final round won't offer many arguments in terms of policy. In the interview, Macron rejected his nickname, President of the Rich, but also promised that his re-election will bring right-wing changes to pensions that could cost him with older voters. He repeatedly admitted that he has made mistakes in his comportment, but not in his policies, and claimed that the corona pandemic made him more sensitive to the needs of the average person. Many said the interview appeared like a campaign speech, but Macron has still not yet declared if he is running for re-election. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Iran says Britain, France, and Germany have agreed to incorporate the proposals of the country's negotiating team in a draft text that will form the basis of future negotiations. The talks are aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, leading to the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to its JCPOA commitments. Homolesky reports.
As the seventh round of talks aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna, Iran says its new proposals and amendments will be included in a text that all sides have agreed will form the basis of future negotiations. Iranian lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani said the sides had come up with two new drafts, one on the removal of U.S. sanctions and another on Iran's nuclear commitments, that were different from the text that had been discussed in the previous round of talks that ended in June. Bagheri said Iran had resisted attempts by the three European signatories of the JCPOA, Britain, France and Germany, to go back to the June text.
In the past week, up until Thursday, we faced an illogical position from the Europeans whereby they wanted to omit the viewpoints of the Iranian side as a basis for talks. Ultimately, with the resistance of the Iranian side and with the reasoning and logic of the Iranian side, they accepted that the Islamic Republic's viewpoints be included in the nuclear draft and form the basis of negotiations.
The EU coordinator said if tough political decisions are not made soon, saving the JCPOA would no longer be possible.
We are in a situation, both in sanctions and nuclear, where difficult political decisions have to be taken. So, again, it is not going to be easy. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be complex. It's going to be politically painful.
EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the delegates don't have months but rather weeks to come to an agreement. He urged all sides to establish clear priorities and to come back with open and realistic viewpoints about what can be achieved. Homa Lesky, Vienna.
Iran blasts the UN General Assembly resolution on the situation of human rights in the country, calling it biased and unconstructive. Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN says the resolution, passed Thursday, is politicized and distorts facts on the ground. Zahra Ershadi says the document exposes the hostile policy of its sponsors and their intention to incite Iranophobia. Ershadi urged the countries that did not back the resolution to protest what she called deceitful moves against independent nations. The UN General Assembly passed the resolution on Thursday with 78 votes in favor, against 31 votes, with 69 abstentions. It accuses Iran of widespread violations of human rights, which Tehran vehemently denies.
On Thursday, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution on the situation of human rights in Iran. Pushed by Canada, the resolution expresses serious concern over, quote, alarmingly high rate of the imposition of death penalty in Iran, including those against child offenders. 76 countries voted in favor of the resolution, and 31 countries voted against it, while 69 others abstained. Iran's High Council for Human Rights was quick to deplore what he called a politically motivated measure replete with factual errors.
There is no international rule that bans the death penalty for people under 18. Furthermore, Article 1 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child defines a child as every human being below the age of 18 years, unless the national law considers majority attained at an earlier age. Well, in the Islamic Republic, a child has a different definition, so it's not illegal in Iran to execute a person under 18. Yet I should add that the number of minus 18 people who receive death penalty in Iran is insignificant.
Tehran views the new resolution as a clear example of double standards at the United Nations. The Islamic Republic urged the international body to open its eyes to the devastating effects of U.S. sanctions on the health sector in Iran. Tehran says those sanctions have denied thousands of Iranians access to life-saving medicine.
Iran is the major victim of sanctions. The United States has admitted that it has put in place an unprecedented sanctions against Iran. Isn't this a violation of human rights? Then why has the UN stopped short of condemning the illegal and unilateral sanctions on the Iranian nation? If you are so concerned about the rights of few prisoners who have committed crimes against the Iranian nation, you also need to take into account the rights of millions of Iranians who cannot access medical supplies just because of the sanctions.
Tehran also referred the UN to Canada's track record of rights abuse against the Aboriginal people, particularly disproportionate violence against indigenous women. Tehran said these are manifestations of deep-rooted colonialism, which Canada has been practicing with impunity. The Islamic Republic called on the UN to avoid a selective approach toward human rights. It said dialogue and cooperation based on mutual respect and equal footing is the only way to ensure the promotion and protection of human rights at the international level.
The Islamic Republic regards itself as a major victim of rights violation, many of which, it says, were committed by the proponents of the recent anti-Iran resolution. So Tehran says those countries are in no position to lecture others on human rights, and such resolutions will only kill the chance for constructive dialogues. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Australia reports record high new COVID-19 cases for a third consecutive day, especially in its two most populous states. Officials in New South Wales and Victoria together registered over 4,000 infections in the past 24 hours. That is higher than case numbers recorded one day earlier. However, Prime Minister Scott Morrison continues to downplay the risks as his government eases pandemic curbs. Morrison argues that the focus should be on hospitalization and cases in ICUs rather than actual tallies. In the latest easing of the curbs, fully vaccinated international travelers will no longer be isolated in Sydney and in Melbourne. Australia shut down its borders soon after the virus break there in early 2020. That kept its cases down relative to other rich nations. The country has so far recorded about 239,000 infections and over 2,100 related deaths. The Omicron variant of the coronavirus has caused fresh concerns in India, leaving health experts pondering if the vaccines are effective against the variant. As Munawwar Zaman reports, the cases have subdued over the last few months, but the pandemic has left a collateral damage of immeasurable extent. Here's more from New Delhi.
The new variant of the COVID-19 pandemic has caused fresh worries in the world's second most populous nation. The Indian subcontinent, which encountered deadly episode of the early pandemic, is now gearing up for yet another phase. The country is on high alert, with many health experts fearing if the country is ready to face a new challenge. Based on the World Health Organization, the variant is spreading at the fastest pace compared with earlier ones.
This is scientific knowledge, but our approach broadly is to do full-blown genomic sequencing in a systematic way from international travelers and also from the cases of COVID that we are now detecting.
Based on health ministry data, 55% of the eligible population has been fully vaccinated, while 87% have received the first dose. Now, in the wake of rapid spread of the super variant Omicron, the country is gearing up for worst scenario. Health experts say there is a chance current vaccines becoming ineffective in emerging situations. India's Omicron case tally stood at 73 on Thursday, with New Delhi, Rajasthan, Maharashtra, Tamil Nadu, Telangana and West Bengal reporting new variants.
Nothing to panic. We must stay calm. We must stay indoor. We must follow the COVID guidelines. People are careless. People are not wearing masks. They are making overcrowding. And that's why this corona is spreading like a fire.
India reported its lowest number of active COVID-19 cases in 18 months on Thursday. Based on government data, the total number of COVID infection in the country stands at 87,000, lowest since March. India's overall COVID-19 caseload has surged to 34 million. Many fear the reoccurrence of April, when the country was ravaged by severe healthcare crisis with people battling for oxygen. The subcontinent is still recovering from the collateral damage of immeasurable extent, such as rising poverty, unemployment, and migrant crisis, besides economic slowdown. With this new variant picking up pace rapidly, health authorities have been urging people to abide by basic COVID guidelines to avoid a similar situation that collapsed the country's healthcare during the second wave. Now fears are also growing of another economic slowdown and fresh travel restrictions. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
South Korea has pressed forward for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. The United States has largely foiled the initiative, however, issuing fresh sanctions on North Korea. South Korea's unification minister remains optimistic that there can be some new, more peaceful arrangement for the region as the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, nears the end of his term.
South Korea this week continued efforts for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. President Moon Jae-in sought Australia's support for the peace-building effort, while his unification minister in Seoul told a forum that the time had come to replace the armistice with a permanent peace.
Never in the 68-year history of the ceasefire have the concerned countries gathered and such discussion materialized for an end of the Korean War. But if we just let this opportunity pass, we cannot imagine how much time will be wasted before a complete end of war on the Korean Peninsula, where strategic interests intersect so fiercely.
The United States, however, Friday issued further sanctions against North Korean officials and organizations, dampening South Korea's attempts at engagement. North Korea sees hypocrisy in U.S. criticism of its military and U.S.-led sanctions. Still, some analysts believe Pyongyang is open to negotiations.
North Korea's request for the elimination of double standards and an end to the hostile policy toward it indicates that if South Korea and the United States show sincerity, then they will willingly discuss the issues with South Korea and the U.S.
Analysts have also suggested the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics may offer a chance to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for some type of contact, but the U.S. has announced its diplomats will boycott the Games. An official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War may offer South Korean President Moon Jae-in some tangible result for the peacekeeping efforts he's made throughout his term. But next year we'll see a new president elected here in South Korea, and perhaps far different policies in terms of inter-Korean relations. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The super typhoon sweeping through the Philippines leaves a trail of death and destruction. At least 23 people are now confirmed dead in the strongest storm to hit the archipelago this year. Typhoon Rey has ravaged southern and central regions of the Philippines, forcing more than 300,000 people to flee their homes. Packing winds of 195 kilometers per hour, the storm has ripped off roofs, toppled power poles, and uprooted trees. People are now without communications and electricity in many areas. Floods caused by torrential rain have hit villages also. Officials say reports of devastation are alarming on the islands that have taken the brunt of the storm. Over 18,000 military, police, Coast Guard, and fire personnel are joining search and rescue efforts in the worst affected regions. And that is for World News.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Global experts fear countries with older and more vulnerable populations may have different experience of Omicron variant of the coronavirus. We are prepared for you an article written by Peter Beaumont. The piece is titled Vaccines and Natural Immunity are Limiting Latest COVID Wave. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to South Africa's health minister, vaccines and high levels of prior exposure to coronavirus in this country appear to be protecting against the more severe symptoms seen in the previous three waves of the pandemic. The suggestion that previous exposure to another variant of coronavirus or vaccination might provide protection from the Omicron variant echoes analysis by South African experts recently that suggested prior exposure or vaccination gave a degree of protection from serious disease. That has been backed by several reports, including by public and private health providers, that suggest a lower level of hospital admissions during the current wave. Echoing the findings of Shabir Mahdi, a vaccine expert at the University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, the health minister, Joe Fala, told the news conference, "We believe that it might not necessarily just be that Omicron is less virulent, but coverage of vaccination and natural immunity of people who have already had contact with the virus is also adding to the protection. That's why we're seeing mild illness in South Africa. While there has been an increase in hospitalizations and deaths in South Africa in recent days, driven by the surge in cases of the Omicron variant, along with continuing infections by the Delta variant, health officials say it remains at lower levels than in previous waves." Michelle Groom from the National Institute for Communicable Diseases says, "We are starting to see a slight increase in deaths nationally, but once again this level is very much lower even than the baseline period we were seeing between the second and third waves." She added that these were relatively small increases in the number of deaths. Wasila Jassat, also from the National Institute for Communicable Diseases, says the number of people requiring oxygen was lower than in any previous period. She said patients do seem to stay for a shorter duration. The health minister, Fala, said early indications were that infections may have peaked in Gauteng province, where cases initially surged. However, the latest figures from the National Institute for Communicable Diseases showed that Gauteng continued to account for most new COVID infections as of 16th of December at 27%, followed by KwaZulu-Natal 23% and Western Cape Province 19%. His comments came as the G7 group of countries called the Omicron variant the biggest current threat to global public health, saying it was more important than ever for countries to closely cooperate. While South Africa's experience with Omicron has been carefully watched around the world for evidence of how infections may progress, experts say populations with larger numbers of older and more vulnerable people may experience it differently. Given how infectious the Omicron variant is, one of the most pressing concerns is that the very rapid and concentrated burst of infections that it provokes could overwhelm national health systems because of the sheer numbers. However, the South African press conference on Friday, 17th of December, goes to the heart of a number of the unknowns about the Omicron variant. While it has been established that Omicron variant is more infectious and more able to evade neutralizing antibodies provided by vaccines and prior exposure, questions remain over whether other aspects of the body's acquired immunity to COVID-19 may be mitigated against more serious disease. According to some experts, while the Omicron variant may be more easily able to evade key neutralizing antibodies that stick to the virus's spike protein, other tools in the immune system's repertoire of defenses, including so-called killer T cells, may still be doing their job. A presentation given by Wendy Burgess of the University of Cape Town at a World Health Organization symposium into evidence of Omicron evading immunity recently indicated preliminary research appeared to suggest that the body's T-cell response remains strong against Omicron. That, however, remains in question, with England's chief medical officer telling the House of Commons recently that there was a lack of very good T-cell studies to establish whether this was happening. South Africa has given 44% of its adult population at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine, more than many African countries, but well short of the government's year-end target. Among the over-50s, vaccination coverage levels are more than 60%. The latest information out of South Africa came as Omicron continued to spread rapidly around the globe, with India, which suffered a devastating Delta outbreak earlier this year, reporting 101 cases in 11 provinces. Denmark's Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, said theatres, cinemas, concert halls, amusement parks, museums and art galleries must all shut down to contain the spread of coronavirus in some of Europe's toughest new measures. Germany's Health Minister, Karl Lauterbach, also warned that he expected the Omicron variant to lead to a massive fifth wave of the pandemic. Karl Lauterbach, a former epidemiology professor, said during a visit to the Lower Saxony region that Germany must prepare for a challenge that we have never seen in this form before. Large US companies are now pulling back on plans to return to in-person work in light of the Omicron variant's rapid spread across the United States. Employers planning to call remote workers back into the office in the new year are now pausing those efforts, and they are wary of setting new return dates only to push them back once again in the face of continued uncertainty and risks from the pandemic. The pandemic is also driving changes in how in-person employees work, with a renewed push for strikes and unionization across several industries where workers have frequently faced long hours and unsafe working conditions. Alphabet's Google, Meta, Apple, Uber, Lyft, Ford, DoorDash, DocuSign and Fidelity are among the companies that have delayed returns to the office. Apple's chief executive officer Tim Cook told employees in a memo recently that the partial return of officers planned for 1st of February was now pushed to a date yet to be determined after several other delays over the past 2 years. Tim Cook offered employees a $1,000 bonus to help improve their home offices. He said Apple's offices remain open and employees are still going in to work in countries with lower COVID rates, but he specifically pointed to the global rise in cases and the emergence of the Omicron variant as a cause for concern. Google and Uber were among the first to announce the indefinite delays in early December after planning for early January returns. Google planned to reopen its offices fully no later than 10th of January, but has now delayed that deadline indefinitely, though offices in several places have already reopened. Meta was planning to open early in 2022, but is now allowing workers to come back as late as June. Janelle Gale, the company's vice president of human resources, said, "Some aren't quite ready to come back." In contrast, Twitter went fully remote forever in October. Lyft's offices will open in February, but workers can stay remote for the entirety of next year, one of the longest delayed returns, partly due to worries over Omicron variant and other variants that may emerge. Fidelity Investments said recently it was pausing its return to work plans. DocuSign has delayed its fourth attempt to return. DoorDash's corporate employees were going back to the office in 2022 in a hybrid approach, but now the company is waiting to see what the new plan should be. Ford planned to return with a hybrid work model for employees working at the headquarters in January, but that is now planned for March. Notably, hourly employees at Ford returned to in-person work in May of 2020. And gig workers at Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and elsewhere have continued working through the pandemic, despite frequently feeling unsafe on their job. According to a Gallup opinion poll, about half of full-time workers surveyed in the United States said their jobs could be done remotely. And nearly one-third of the workers said they never wanted to work in the office in person. The majority wanted a hybrid model.
Spotlight. Welcome to Spotlight. UK's ruling Conservatives have lost the seat of North Shropshire, a seat they held for nearly 200 years, to the Liberal Democrats in a by-election blow to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The embattled Premier says that he takes personal responsibility for his party's very disappointing by-election results, and he totally understands why people in the district are frustrated. The seat became vacant after a Conservative ally of Johnson stepped down over breaking lobbying rules. The Prime Minister has been hit by several setbacks and scandals in recent weeks, including a surging Omicron variant and tanking approval ratings. He's also particularly plagued by recent allegations about his government staff attending Christmas parties last year in violation of COVID restrictions. Johnson has denied that any rules were broken and has ordered an inquiry. Joining us now from London is Sai Puruza with more details on this, in what, by many cases, devastating loss for the Conservatives. Sai?
It definitely is, Bardia, a devastating loss for the Conservatives, and it is really has come as a shock to members of the Conservative Party, particularly because it's happened at the very heart of Conservative territory. As you said earlier, these are areas where the Conservatives have had enormous majorities for decades and decades, and for that to happen, for such a massive electoral swing to happen to the Liberal Democrats, really is a shocker. And some are saying this was not necessarily a vote for the Lib Dems, rather a vote against the Conservatives, a warning shot to them to get their act together, for this government to get its act together. And what is really very, very important is the scale of this change that has taken place. They had more than 23,000 lead, and now the Lib Dems have managed to turn that around. So the scale of it is very important. Partly it's got to do with what's been happening over the past few weeks. For example, the stories of the parties that took place last year, this time, that we continue to endlessly hear about the fact that there were images of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's own advisors and laughing at the public, making a mockery of the guidelines that they themselves said if the public went to such great lengths to adhere to. And also stories of how the Prime Minister couldn't afford refurbishing his own residence, number 10, Downing Street, and had to ask a Conservative Party donor to fork over £100,000 to fit that bill for him. And aside from all of that, Mario, we're in the middle of a public health emergency. And some of the messaging coming out of Downing Street has really been confusing. We have seen, for example, some of that reflect in members of the government contradicting the country's chief medical officer in the past few days. And so what is happening right now is members of the Conservative Party are asking the question about this Prime Minister, whether or not he is fit to stay in power. Can he lead them through the next election to victory? And of course, there is no settled view on that. The vote seems to be split. Some of the MPs saying that he is still a winner, that he can deliver if given the time. But there are others who are saying, in their words, that leopards cannot change their spots, that perhaps it is time to look for an alternative to Boris Johnson. And you see, the bucket of bad news pouring over Boris Johnson does not stop there. There are two investigations that are ongoing as we speak, one into the his apartment refurbishing, and also allegations of parties or into Christmas Gate, parties that allegedly took place last year. The outcome of those inquiries out soon, and in the words of some analysts and members of the Conservative Party as well, he has received two big blows of late. One, the rebellion by members of his own party on the question of whether or not to introduce more strict restrictions in light of the Omicron variant ripping through the population, more infections being announced every day so far, and with things even getting worse and breaking more records, according to the chief medical officer, in the coming weeks and months, and also this election defeat. And it seems that if this prime minister and his government receive another blow as potent as these two, he's going to be out, Mario.
All right, thanks a lot, Saeed Presti. Saeed Puruza joining us from the British capital, London. But however, joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst Fra Hughes joining us from Belfast. And also senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, is joining us from New York. Let's start off with Mr. Williams in New York. Sir, how did the Conservatives lose one of their safest seats to the Lib Dems?
Complete incompetence, the visible signs of lying and dissimulation, the abuse of privilege, attempts to lie to the public. It's quite a big rap. The amazing thing is it's taken this long to turn out. But you have to put it in the context that this time last year, people in Britain were not going to hospitals to bid farewell to their family when they were dying. They weren't going to hospitals when mothers were having children. Families were not able to see each other during the holiday season because they were obeying the laws that the regulations laid down by the government, whose members were carousing and cavorting in number 10 Downing Street. So this is really sort of playing the fiddle while Rome burns. It's got an extra resonance. And, of course, it's on top of increasing visible and irrefutable signs of incompetence on the part of Boris Johnson. He has an assembly of charlatans and moneymakers, confidence tricksters, people who lie regularly, people who are looting the public purse for contracts, continual revelations about his ministers making money on COVID contracts to produce useless cures, useless equipment. It really is amazing that he's lasted this long. And part of the reason for that, which is revealed here, is the complete incompetence of the opposition. I mean, Keir Starmer has all the charisma of a cold rice pudding, and it shows that it's one of the reasons why Labour was trashed. But no one's voting for the Liberal Democrats. The Liberal Democrats have, for many years now, been a party where you say none of the above by ticking next to them. On the few occasions they've had any responsibility, was in the coalition with the Conservatives, where they're every bit as big. It was a Liberal minister who privatised the Royal Mail, for example, the post office, when he was in the coalition. So they've got much to answer for, but they managed to evade responsibility because it was the coalition, and people are forgetting that. They're coming back to it. They are now that none of the above column.
But sure.
It really is difficult to work out where things will go. One of the signs that some commentators have assumed is this may mean that the Brexit coalition that brought Boris Johnson in there might be losing its steam. The people might realize that there's more to life than Union Jacks and square sausages and any of the other trivia that he was played such a part in promulgating during the Brexit campaign.
Mr. Hughes, in Belfast, how big of a setback is this for Boris Johnson and his Tories in the views of many, the event in North Shropshire could be the beginning of the end for the Tory rule? What do you think?
I think it's very easy to jump on the bandwagon that says having lost a safe Conservative seat that they've held for over 200 years, it's a damning indictment of the government. It's a damning indictment of Boris Johnson's leadership. But I think we should also bear in mind that it's only 2 years ago that Boris Johnson won a landslide victory on behalf of the Conservative Party. They gained a net gain of 48 seats, and they had 43.6% of the popular vote. So we're in halfway through the parliamentary five-year cycle. We are in the middle of a pandemic. It's been handled appallingly by Boris Johnson and his government. I think a lot of the backlash that we've seen in North Shropshire is actually coming from the fact that the incumbent MP had to resign because of his lobbying tactics. So he was seen as an untrustworthy person within the Conservative Party holding that particular seat on behalf of the Conservative Party. And it is a reflection of the Conservative government and the corruption that seems to have embedded itself so deeply in the heart of the government. But considering that Boris Johnson turned a red wall into a blue wall in the north of England, I think a lot of the people that have been elected with Boris Johnson in 2019 should show him some loyalty going forward. There's no election until 2024. We've seen peerages for to be bought. We have seen cash for questions. We have seen passports for sale. There's always been corruption in government. There's always been a backlash during the governmental cycle. And I think Boris Johnson could ride this out unless there is a leadership battle, which is more to do with the internal machinations of the Conservative Party than it is anything to do with this latest electoral defeat or where he stands in the polls of public opinion.
Ian Williams, Conservative Party Chairman Oliver Dowden said, "I know that the voters of North Shropshire are fed up and they wanted to give us a kicking. We've heard that message loud and clear." What message was that exactly, and what are the Conservatives going to do about it?
Well, I think that from the point of view of the Conservative Chairman and the others, the big problem was Boris Johnson and his colleagues got caught. Not that they did it, they got caught. This government and this generation of politicians have few, if any, ethical scruples whatsoever about doing what they do. It's getting caught in public. And they haven't got caught as often because they haven't had to deal, in fact, with any type of vigorous press. What they've had to deal with was a press that is overwhelmingly an Amen corner and has supported them through thick and thin and made apologies for them. I gather the Sun's website this morning, the Murdoch Press, didn't even mention the by-election loss. It led off on far more of the important things. So it's typical of the misleading from the media. But Conservative Party leadership isn't designated by the public, isn't designated even by the mass of Conservative members. We're quite right. It's the people who were just elected on his coattails. When they think that Boris Johnson is going to lose them their safe seats and their sinecures and their access to power and their ability to dip the public purse, that's when there'll be a country house conclave somewhere. All of his old mates from the public schools in Oxbridge will get together for a gathering one weekend, and Boris will be carried out on a stretcher with a knife in his back. It's what happened to Margaret Thatcher. It's what happened to all his previous incumbents who passed their vote-by date in the Conservative Party. They don't do it on popular revolts. It's done behind back doors. You know, the butler never did it, but someone in the Conservative Party will have done it, and he will be forced to resign. Whether he goes to the next election or not, if he does, it will be fatally flawed. But he's saved by one redeeming feature, is that who else is there? There aren't any serious contenders in the Conservative Party, because they're all every bit as corrupt and ineffectual as he is. There's in the Labour Party, I mean, I've never seen such an appallingly mediocre lineup. Regardless of what their plain politics are, and most of them evade the politics completely, they are complete mediocrities. I wouldn't elect them to a parish council. And the Liberal Democrats, their only benefit, as I said, is they're the box that you say, I don't like any of them. So it doesn't matter who they put up, but people will vote for them rather than vote for Keir Starmer or Boris Johnson.
Mr. Hughes.
So it really is an abysmal state of British politics. Without vision, the politicians may as well perish.
We'll get back to you in a minute, Ian Williams. Mr. Hughes. Boris Johnson says that he takes responsibility, personal responsibility, for his party's disappointing results in North Shropshire. He said he totally understands why people are frustrated in the district. Talking about the effect of that, will we see a new and refined Boris Johnson after this, or will it be the same plethora of mistakes?
I think Boris has been defined by his failures in politics as much as his successes. He's been forced to resign from different positions within the party in the past. I think the way forward for Boris, he's a bungling idiot who bumbled his way to the top of the tree of the British political elite within the Conservative Party. He's like a Pooh Bear character who seems to stagger from one kind of a crisis to another. I think really what you'll see from Boris going forward is he'll have to try and rein in some of the people that are leading him into these debacles. I mean, they're claiming that a lot of the flack he gets is about the Christmas party that apparently he didn't attend. And then again, there is this corruption that's seen within the party that I'm not saying he's not associated with, but there's been no public outcry about him personally being involved in this. So I think what he needs to do is rally the troops. He'll have to take like a head count of who supports him, who's maybe out to get him in a kind of parliamentary political coup, try and rally the wagons, and maybe do a cabinet reshuffle. Isn't that what you do when you're in trouble as a prime minister? You have to say who's got your back, and you put them in positions of power in order to protect your own inner sanctum within Parliament. So that's what I would see. Maybe a reshuffle, maybe trying to throw more money at the NHS in order to buy more votes and buy more popularity going forward. But I don't think it matters on one level actually who's in charge. If Boris Johnson went tomorrow, the Conservative Party domestic and foreign policy wouldn't change. And for a working class person who's on minimum wage, for a refugee seeking asylum, and for someone who's on an NHS waiting list, whoever runs the Conservative Party will make no material difference to their lives.
Ian Williams, we can't talk about Boris Johnson's government and the Conservatives without mentioning Brexit. Now, I was listening to some interviews earlier prepping up for the show, and the Tories, they feel that they've delivered on the bigger issues, for example, getting Brexit done. But Brexit is still a spider web of ambiguities, disagreements, economic setbacks. How did they deliver on Brexit when the deal itself has turned into a reason of dissatisfaction among the British public?
Well, you know, Brexit was a mixed thing. It meant different things to different people. There's a genuine working class patriotism in Britain that had been fermented to regard everything as European interference. And many of the things Europe was actually protecting many working class people, like the unions and other, well, forms of democracy, against the locals, the local rapacious conservatives. So it's very mixed. But the message coming across was it was patriotic. Now, what's patriotic about having a bumbling idiot of an Etonian who is on the verge of pushing Northern Ireland out, as you would appreciate from there, out of the Union, and consequently bringing possibly Scotland and Wales out as well? There's nothing patriotic about this at all. And of course, he's completely silent on the issue of Wales, Scotland, and in fact, the north of England. I mean, his is a home county government. It's a regional government. Even with the famous Red Wall going.
All right, Mr. Hughes, when we're talking about Brexit, the Conservatives feel they've delivered, but looking at the outcome of it, maybe it's the opposite.
Well, they have delivered in that they have technically taken the United Kingdom, or England, Scotland and Wales, out of the European Union. Now, the fact that the Northern Ireland remains part of the single market for the economy and for exports and stuff because of the Good Friday Agreement, and of not wanting to have a hard border on the island of Ireland, so the border is in the British Channel. I think people voted to leave the European Union on many different levels. It was sold as many different things as our friend has said to many different people. It has failed in some respects because the British economy is faltering. With the pandemic, you see, there's been a convergence of different things that have happened. Britain leaving the EU alongside the pandemic. With the pandemic, we had tens of thousands of people, taxi drivers, lorry drivers, people involved in the hospitality industry, all kind of laid off, found different jobs. So there is an issue with bringing goods into Britain outside of the border control issue, because there's a shortage of drivers, because people left that particular employment because of COVID, and because the jobs just didn't exist. So Britain's suffering from a lack of imports. There have been queries around foodstuffs on the shelves in and on the British supermarkets. But we can see that as inflation picks up and the interest rates begin to bite and people's incomes begin to falter, I think on an economic level going forward, Britain is definitely going to struggle in the next couple of years. And I think that could have a profound effect on the government itself going forward.
Sure. Mr. Williams is back with us for one last question. Ian, I know you addressed this a little earlier before, but I want you to look into your crystal ball and give us a prediction. Do you think that Boris Johnson will be Prime Minister and leader of the party as Britain comes to the next general election? Very briefly, if you may, because we're running out of time.
Well, no. He can reshuffle his cabinet, but, I mean, how can you reshuffle something when every card in the pack is a joker? He really has no... He's driven out all the substantial people, or they've walked out holding their noses in disgust at his behaviour. All of the, you know, the Tories of principle and ethics. I often find that difficult to say. But there are people, and he's driven them all out. What he's surrounded himself is what in British parlance we call flyboys and con men and women, who are visibly disdainful of the common people around them. They're not populists. Brexit was a populist cause, but these people aren't populists. They have profound disdain for the voters, and it shows with every pronouncement. So, I think he's going to be hard put, the Tory party is going to be hard put to find a credible alternative, but they will still try to get rid of him because he's got too much radiation attached to him.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist and political analyst Frog, he's joining us from Belfast. And thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, joining us from New York. Also, special thanks to our for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
It's been a long time since her birthday. It's been a long time she asked her husband before her departure from this world that nobody should take part in her burial. We're going to know about the personality of her, the daughter of Allah's last messenger. This is like Fatima. As-salamu alayki ya
binta Rasulillah. Peace be on you, O daughter of the Messenger of Allah. Peace be on you, O daughter of the Prophet of Allah. Peace be on you, O daughter of the dearest beloved of Allah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Hello and welcome to our program about the life of the Honorable Fatima Zahra. Peace be upon her. I am your host, Rashida Hanif. With me in the studio today is Miss Zahra Moussaoui, who received her bachelor's degree from King's College in England and is now a teacher at the Islamic College for Women. Assalamu alaikum to you, Ms. Moussaoui.
Assalamu alaikum.
And today we want to speak about a sad topic again, the funeral of the Honorable Fatima Zahra. Now, what were Fatima Zahra's last instructions in the final moments of her life?
Now, when the time, the final moments of her life arrived and it was time for her to pass into the next world, for some reason, it's not clear. Her family were not next to her. So Imam Ali and her children were not there. Maybe Imam Ali had taken the children out. They couldn't see the last moments of their mother's life because it's very difficult for a child. And some say that she sent her daughters to another lady's house so that they wouldn't be there to witness her passing. But Esma was next to her. The right. Faithful Esma was next
That's
to her.
Right.
And some also say that Fidla was beside her.
Okay.
When the last moments of her life arrived, she said, "Peace be on Jibra'il. Peace be on the Prophet of God. O God, select me to accompany the Prophet. Drown me in your love and happiness, and give me refuge in your mercy, beside your house of love, well-being, and safety." She then asked those beside her, "Do you see what I see?" They said, "Why? What do you see?" Fatima replied, "These are many, many angels, and this is Jibra'il, and that is the Prophet of God, who is saying, 'My daughter, come to us, because what you have with us is better for you.'"